Hey, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of The Negotiation. Today, I am joined by Ed Sander, a renowned analyst specializing in China's digital technology landscape. In the first part of our two-part conversation, Ed shares his expert insights into Pinduoduo and the meteoric rise of its international marketplace, Temu. The episode kicks off with Ed discussing the innovative business strategies, such as group buying and aggressive discounting, that have propelled Pinduoduo to immense success within China. He then shifts focus to Temu, PDD Holdings' ambitious cross-border platform, explaining its business model and why it has rapidly emerged as a formidable contender in the global e-commerce arena, potentially rivaling giants like Amazon. Ed addresses common misconceptions about Temu, providing clarity on its operational strategies and market positioning. He also explains the semi-managed model, highlighting its significance in Temu's operational framework and its impact on international e-commerce dynamics. Additionally, Ed discusses his upcoming study trip to China with Kaiser Kuo, inviting listeners to gain firsthand experience and a deeper understanding of China's tech landscape. Enjoy.
Basically, what PDD did is they used all of the supply chain relationships that they already had with merchants, but also with manufacturers, to fill the platform with different SKUs. Now, of course, if you talk to a lot of factories specifically, they are not very well experienced in cross-border e-commerce. They know how to make stuff, but they have no clue how to sell it to a Western consumer. They don't speak English. They don't know about customer habits outside China. So basically what Pinduoduo offered them is, we can do that for you. So we'll do that for you. The only thing you guys have to do is give us your lowest price possible. You put it in our warehouses. We won't buy it from you. It's still owned by the merchant, and we'll sell it on your behalf. So that's what they call like a consignment model, or the fully managed model that Pinduoduo started with. That meant that as soon as it was in their warehouse, Temu would sell it to Western consumers. Now, of course, everybody needs to have the app to buy. So you pour enormous amounts of money into social media to advertise the platform and have people download it, and then use the same gamification method to actually do sort of a member get member scheme, where you get a free product if you help me sign up just additional users. Because of this combination of advertising and gamification, a member gets member, they very quickly grew to something, I think they're close to 500 million users at the moment.
Home to over 4 billion people, the Asia-Pacific region boasts one of the most powerful consumer markets on the planet. Not only is it home to half of the world's under 30 population, but it's also home to more than half the world's internet users. It's a market that no globally minded organization should ignore. But entering markets like China, Japan, or Southeast Asia is no easy task. Just ask the likes of Microsoft, Google, Uber, and Facebook. However, times are changing, and with the right partners, doors are slowly opening as more and more companies find success growing their key markets in APAC. I myself spent 8 years in China, mostly as a venture capitalist, helping early-stage tech companies grow in the Asia-Pacific market successfully. This show is dedicated to uncovering and examining successful Asia market entry and growth strategies by interviewing the experts who've done it before and truly understand what it takes to be successful in the region. My name is Todd Embley, and welcome to The Negotiation, brought to you by WPIC Marketing and Technologies. Ed, welcome to The Negotiation Podcast.
Thank you, Todd, and thanks for having me.
All right, tell us a little bit. Where are you in the wide world today that we're recording you from?
In the wide world, I'm currently located in the Netherlands. That's where I live, although I spend about 3 or 4 months every a year in China. I just came back from China, where I spent the whole of July. But I'm currently in the Netherlands and preparing a couple of articles that we got to publish on Temu for TechBus China.
Where do you usually go? Do you switch it up when you go to China, or do you usually go to the same place?
Well, there's three places that I go to quite regularly, and that's Beijing, Shanghai, and Hangzhou, also because we deliver study tours with one of our ventures. And that's normally the places that we go to, but I'm also married to a Chinese lady, and her parents live in Datong in Shaanxi province. So I go there quite often. I lived in Xi'an for a couple of years, so we have friends there. And what I also try to do is try to visit a new province every year that I haven't been to. I think I only got something like 5 provinces left. So I'm normally, all over the place, but most of the time in Beijing, Shanghai, Hangzhou.
How many provinces are there? They're like 40 I think plus.
It depends on if you count the autonomous regions and the municipalities. But I think it's something between 25 and 30 in total.
Okay. Yeah. So you're doing pretty well on your exploration.
Yeah, I do.
I've been to a few. I went to Hangzhou once, a dead middle of China. You know, I've been up to Harbin. I've been down to Sanya. I never made it out to Chengdu, never been to Chongqing. So there's definitely a few places. I've never been to Xi'an, home of the Terracotta Warriors, if I'm not mistaken.
What?
Yeah, I know.
You should be ashamed of yourself.
And I've never been to Guilin, which is crazy because it's absolutely one of the most beautiful places that I've seen in pictures to go. Never made it there. Never made it there. But been to Xiamen, which was beautiful. And of course, that whole Guangdong region, right? You mentioned Guangzhou and Shenzhen. Those are very popular tech hubs as well. Like WeChat, I know they had some big operations. I had a friend who was a director with, he actually ran the WeChat stuff out of Hangzhou. It's amazing. You can't, swing a stick without hitting a tech hub in China these days. So tell us a little bit more, just, your background. How did this relationship and friendship with China come about?
Well, it's a bit of a typical story because my background is in marketing and CRM and database marketing originally. Mm. And I'd been doing that for about 20 years. And I also traveled a lot in Asia and I got really interested in Asian cultures, also in Buddhism. I found that fascinating. So I had been to Tibet, but I hadn't been to the rest of China yet. And I got so fascinated with Asia that I signed up to do volunteering with an organization called VSO, Voluntary Service Overseas, where you basically go and do volunteering work in your own skills. You don't go do something random like teach English, but you go in and help NGOs with your own skills. And they asked me if I wanted to go to China. And initially I thought, well, this is not really like an underdeveloped country anymore, right? But they said that they were sort of phasing out sending volunteers there and they needed people to help China set up local volunteering centers. And I spent 2 years in Xi'an from 2011 to 2023, so a bit longer than 2 years, working as a marketing consultant at different NGOs in Xi'an.
That's amazing. Okay, yeah. I haven't been back in a few years, and ever since COVID, it was super tough. But I am anxious to get back and maybe I'll be a tourist instead of a resident next time I go. And maybe I'll go to Xi'an and I'll go to Guilin and I'll knock those places out. I just really want to go to Chengdu because I love Sichuan. So
it's the best cuisine from China. Sichuan,
right? I know. Okay. So let's dive in and we're going to start with Pinduoduo. I guess if you could start by explaining the rise of Pinduoduo domestically in China, and then we'll get into other things like Temu and whatnot. But let's start with just focused on the PDD platform.
So if you look at PDD and you go back to about 2015, I think, they used to have two platforms. One platform where they were selling, I think it was mostly fruit, and they also were also doing a gamification platform. So they did gamification as well, and they sort of merged these two things together, and that became Pinduoduo. And basically what they've been doing since, I think, 2016 is doing a C2M model, consumer to manufacturing, where on the one hand, they aggregate a lot of demand by a group buying mechanism, but also by this gamification. And they sort of use that demand that they can create to get very low prices on the supply side from manufacturers. And if you link these two up, basically what the consumer gets is very low prices and the manufacturer gets a very high volume. And that's the idea behind the basic idea behind the platform. Now, if you add on top of that all kinds of gamification where people are constantly drawn into the app because they can win bigger discounts or free products, then it also becomes very addictive. So the stickiness of the Pinduoduo app very early on was higher than any other Chinese app. And you had just millions and millions of people just playing these silly games where quite often they were asked to look at products to, for instance, gain water that they could use to grow a virtual tree. And if the tree was fully grown, then they would get like the real fruit from a tree like that. But they also needed to invite friends to play these games with them and download the app. So the customer acquisition costs were very low. And because of that gamification as well, they grew enormously fast in a matter of years. They were one of the biggest apps in China.
So much to talk about in here. I have to hold back. And for those that know, the audience that knows my background, because I come from tech and working with startups and venture capital and whatnot. So Ed swims in a pool that is much closer to my kind of realm of knowledge as well. So I am going to have to do my best to kind of hold back and want to dive in and talk about all these kind of things and talk about, you know, CAC versus LTV and all these terms, you know, managing cost of customer acquisition versus long-term value of a customer and all these tech startup-y things. Now let's get into Temu. Now, this is PDD's kind of holdings overseas cross-border platform, which I thought was brilliant. And I'm sure that most of our audience has to be quite fully aware of Temu, just the amount of marketing that they have done globally. Now, I know the algorithms work in our favor, you know, most of the time delivering us these kinds of things. But I have used Temu quite a bit and have bought many things. And one of the, I own a windows and doors company, in fact, and we were getting glass suction cups for moving big pieces of glass. I ordered some off of Temu whilst we already had some in the company that the installers would use. I got them for about half the price of what they were on Amazon. It took about 5 weeks to get here, of course, but when they arrived, I kind of threw them in the mix and the guys started using them and they would come over to me and like, where did you get these suction cups? Like, these are the Cadillac of glass suction cups. These are amazing. They're little pressure gauges and all kinds of things on them. I said, yeah, man, I got them off Temu, got them from China, and they were half what they were on Amazon. Just took a little while to get here. Now that all said, let's start with your take on Temu's success. And then I'll get into we'll get into comparison and the challenging nature of it towards other Western e-commerce platforms. But talk to us, what is Temu and why has it been so successful?
Basically, the story goes back to January 2022. Pinduoduo had enormous cash reserves, but they were sort of bumping into a ceiling of maximum penetration in China. Basically, anybody that would use their app, whether it's in a first-tier city or in a sixth-tier city, everybody was using their app. You can still try to increase the average revenue per user, but there were not that many new people to recruit. So at this point, they started discussing in January 2022, maybe we should do something cross-border, which was totally new, of course, for Pinduoduo. So they sent a couple of people around the world to investigate, and within 9 months, they knocked this Temu platform into shape. So they launched in the States in September 2022. Originally, if you look at the very first screenshots that I took back then, it was really a Shein clone. They were trying to be basically the same as Shein, selling a lot of very cheap clothing. But that very quickly changed, probably also because Shein had covered so much of the supply chain that there's just not that many merchants maybe to actually compete with. So they very quickly changed into something that is much more about household items. Now, if you look at Shein, it's about 70% is clothing, whereas with Temu, that's only about 30%. And you can basically just buy any kind of product, much household, garden related, but all kinds of stuff. What PDD did is they used all of the supply chain relationships that they already had with merchants, but also with manufacturers, to fill the platform with different SKUs. Now, of course, if you talk to a lot of factories specifically, they are not very well experienced in cross-border e-commerce. They know how to make stuff, but they have no clue how to sell it to a Western consumer. They don't speak English. They don't know about customer habits outside China. So basically what Pinduoduo offered them is, we can do that for you. So we'll do that for you. The only thing you guys have to do is give us your lowest price possible. You put it in our warehouses. We won't buy it from you. It's still owned by the merchant, and we'll sell it on your behalf. So that's what they call like a consignment model, or the fully managed model, what Pinduoduo started with. That meant that as soon as it was in their warehouse, Temu would sell it to Western consumers. Now, of course, everybody needs to have the app to buy. So you pour enormous amounts of money into social media to advertise the platform and have people download it, and then use the same gamification method to actually do sort of a member get member scheme, where you get a free product if you help me sign up just additional users. Because of this combination of advertising and gamification, a member gets member, they very quickly grew to something. I think they're close to 500 million users at the moment. Now, what they would do, which is very different from some other business models, is that they would ship it by airplane to the customer. So these packages go in an airplane, which is flown to the country of destination, and there it's being picked up by a domestic or a local logistical service provider that then brings it to the consumer. So that's basically the model that they started with. What they also did is they gave people free shipping, and they gave them very low prices. Not only had they already sort of put the prices down by getting the best price from the manufacturers, and also have them compete against each other in sort of a bidding system, but they further subsidized the prices. So what you would see the first time you would buy on Temu is a lower price, where actually Temu makes no money whatsoever. But it's just subsidizing as customer acquisition costs to get that first order and to buy market share. And as we've seen all over the world, they're now active in 75 different countries. They've been very successful in that part of the business. So
much to say. Can I ask you, and then definitely going off script here a little bit, but I can't help to think, in the early days, because I've dabbled and looked into drop shipping, which became quite the rage, where a lot of entrepreneurial types were doing this. For anybody not familiar with drop shipping, because it has kind of fallen off, you don't really hear about drop shipping the last couple of years anymore, but it was certainly hot and heavy, where people were going to manufacturers' websites, for instance, in China. They were finding products that they thought that they could do some marketing. So they would order some, take some really amazing pictures and videos, and do a bunch of marketing and spin up a quick, you know, website on Wix or just Shopify kind of site. And then even using Amazon fulfillment centers to not even have to touch the product. And they were just doing the marketing and sales. And this was just basically called drop shipping. They were selling a product that they never even saw or were anywhere near. It was sent from China to the customer, or it was brought over in bulk from China to an Amazon fulfillment center. And then it would be sent from there and usually arrive in an Amazon box, which weirded people out sometimes, thinking they hadn't even seen Amazon during their travels or their customer journey. But I digress. I can't help but think that some of the learnings, maybe some of the data from what dropshipping used to be, has also potentially played a role in not only Temu, but AliExpress as well. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, some of the dropshippers, I think, might even order stuff on AliExpress and then have it delivered somewhere else. But I mean, Temu is almost like dropshipping on steroids, where you don't need these different companies in the rest of the world anymore. There's just one, basically one intermediate, and there's no individual dropshippers, and there's also no wholesale, there's no retail. That traditional sales, of course, goes through. So it is a bit like dropshipping on steroids.
Let's look at and juxtapose it against its, you know, the main comparison platform, Amazon, which everybody would immediately think of. Let's just start with this, because there's all sorts of unique features and designs of Temu that are very, very different to Amazon. But is it comparable? Is it a potential challenger to Amazon market share?
I wouldn't say it's comparable because Amazon is much more like a free marketplace, although there are similarities. Of course, Amazon also has this tool where they sort of scan the internet and see if there's prices elsewhere that are lower than on Amazon, and then ask the merchant to lower their prices. That's something that Temu also does, but much more aggressively than Amazon would be possible or would be able to do that. So that's something that is different. Another thing is that with Amazon, of course, they try to convince the merchants, well, you should put it in the warehouse and do fulfillment by Amazon so we can deliver very quickly. And if you don't do that, you're not able to sell to Prime members. So they basically sort of force the merchant to use that model of logistics. Another thing that is very different is that on Amazon, you need to do your own search engine advertising. You need to pay for your own visibility so people can find you. And then when they find you, you need to make sure that you have a lower price than the other products that turn up. And that's the model that Amazon uses to get the lowest prices as well and make money from search engine advertising. With Temu, basically, they have agreed on a price that the factory or the merchants, but most of the time it's factories, will sell it for. But Temu never buys the product, just like Amazon doesn't buy the product unless it's their direct sales, which they started with. But Temu doesn't buy the product, but they get to decide the selling price. The factory doesn't really have any say in that. So they create their own margin and therefore are also able to play with that subsidizing very easily. So that's a very different business model than the business model of Amazon, which is based on getting fees for commission, for fulfillment by Amazon and search engine advertising. So, and also, like I said, the factories that sell through Temu, they don't need to have any knowledge and they don't need to run the products on the platform. That's all basically been done for them. At least that's the fully managed model that Temu started out with. So there are things that overlap, but at the same time, they are also very different in business.
I'm going to jump into this now while I'm thinking about it, because I often, you know, I'm somewhat enamored from a business perspective with how Amazon screws over some of its vendors and has the Amazon Basics model, because they hold all the cards. They hold all the knowledge. And I think when Amazon sees a product that moves fast, has high profit margins, and is something that they can potentially source and make and brand themselves, and then obviously don't have to pay for the promotion or the sponsored positioning of the product and any other manipulations that they want to try to get away with, they can make all that money that somebody else was making from a very hot product that has great margins. Is Temu doing any of that to your knowledge?
No. If what you mean is sourcing that themselves and having that made themselves, they're not doing that. That's not the model that they have either in Pinduoduo or in Temu. What they do in Temu is if they see that a product is very popular, they will try to find more manufacturers that can make exactly the same thing. And especially if you have products that are like mold products that are not very unique, there will be many different factories that can make that. And they will basically go into a bidding system, and the one that can give the lowest price, that will be the one that will start to sell on Temu. If another factory has a lower or higher price than that, they will actually stop the sales of that product. And they might even start charging storage fees for the stuff that is in their warehouses. So, I mean, I think whether you're selling on Amazon or on Temu, you get screwed in from both ways, but just in very different ways with very different models. The same thing also happens because Temu doesn't just have that bidding model, that bidding system, which also like Amazon basically crawls the internet for the lowest price and tells you to lower the price if you're selling on Temu and also compare that to other manufacturers. But they also have a penalty system, and you might not expect it, but Temu has an approach where they basically say the customer is right. When they complain, the customer is right. unless it's somebody that is just abusing the system and is always complaining to keep free stuff, because most of the time they don't let you return the goods, because the cost of having goods returned is much more than the value of the product. And it might be difficult to resell. So in a lot of cases, they basically say, you don't have to return the product. You do have to upload a couple of pictures just as a proof that you actually have the product. You need to tell them what the problem was. So maybe the size was too small or it broke or whatever. But then what they will do is they will fine the manufacturer, the merchant. They will fine them 1 to 5 times the selling price as a penalty for bad quality. Now, the problem is that they never tell the manufacturer or the merchant what the problem was with that product. They just see that the balance in their account just gets lowered because they need to pay all of these penalties. And sometimes, if it's a complaint that occurs multiple times, then Temu might even do that for the whole batch that was delivered into their warehouse. So, yeah, I think that whether you sell on Amazon or on Temu, there's both. In both cases, you might have questions about ethical behavior of the platform.
Yeah, and that's likely a financially driven decision where they just don't even want to open up the conversation or dialogue. There's famously, this is just engaging a human being and opening a conversation is just such a time suck, where I think any dropshipper who's had issues with Stripe and gets, you know, the chargebacks happen and you have no ability to actually have a conversation with Stripe, they've just made a decision and that's binding and that's it and it's over. And they just don't want to bother engaging. It's not worth their time in the long-term vision, 30,000 foot, looking at ROI on everything that they do operationally. It just doesn't make sense to open those conversations. It's interesting. I mean, and putting the screws to manufacturers or sellers, this is not even just a new thing, even on digital. I mean, this is very much a Costco model as well. And this is how, if you want to be in Costco, you are going to pay a very, very heavy price and they're going to demand excellence on product and excellence on price comparison. Even what you mentioned about return and just the cost of logistics, I think Wayfair is pretty famous for that as well. And I've had it happen to myself a few times where I've ordered a product, I've had an issue with how it showed up, the delivery, the color, or even just completely the wrong thing. And Wayfair says, yeah, we'll refund your money. And don't worry, just keep the product and we'll get a new one sent out to you, or, you know, something like this. And I'm like, wow, I got a full refund and I get to keep this. And I'm like, oh yeah, so it's black instead of brown. Oh, I'm going to still use it now because it's free. But it's the power the platform holds. They don't even allow whatever colors or designs or unique styles, they just won't allow you to actually list those on other places. You have to have some sort of differentiation. That's what Wayfair kind of demands, that this not be allowed just as a specific SKU number to be available anywhere else, right? You might be selling more beds or furniture or things other places, but these specific SKUs have to be exclusive to Wayfair. And one might think that this is all in the best interest of the consumer. All of this, you're protecting me, you're getting me low prices, you're crawling. Would that be a true statement or a not true statement to think that these platforms are actually doing everything in the best interest of the consumer?
No, I wouldn't claim that. Although, I mean, if you complain, I have the same experience. If I complain about a product that I bought on Temu, then they say you don't have to return it. And 24 hours later, I get my money back in my bank account. So from a consumer experience, that's quite good. But the question is, I bought about 15 products on Temu and about 6 of them were rubbish. Yeah, you did send me six times rubbish. Now, why is that? Partially because of that bidding system that they're putting so much pressure on the manufacturers that their margins get so thin that cost reduction needs to come from somewhere. And the example that I normally give is you could be a manufacturer of winter coats, but because you have to lower your price, you just put less filling in the coat. So it's actually an autumn coat, but without the consumer knowing it. So because it has to come from somewhere. So on the one hand, they are pressuring the price down, which could lead to low quality, and then punishing the manufacturer when the quality gets too low that it results in complaints, and then trying to balance that. But the whole thing, of course, about the refunds and the returns of goods, it's basically all a question of efficiency. Just at the lowest cost, try to do this. And if there's a problem, we'll just find the manufacturer and have them pay for it. So
you have to protect the customer. Like, this is for Temu or PDD. All of the work and all of the value has gone into breaking that chicken and egg problem of having customers and then having suppliers, almost like a dating platform, right? You know, dating platforms work really, really, really hard to get, in most cases, if it's a straight person dealing, you know, dating platform, you're trying to get the girls on there because then the guys will come, right? And if you own a bar, it's kind of the same thing here. This is kind of your operating. And so this two-sided marketplace kind of platform is they are working really, really hard and spending all of their money not to get suppliers or not to get to, you know, products. They're trying to get the attention, right? Trying to get that digital time spent on platform and numbers and time spent and cart size. And this is everything that they have been working so hard to build. And that's going to be what they're going to viciously protect. So if you're going to challenge that in some way of low quality or higher, too high prices, that where those customers that they've worked so hard to get are going to end up now going somewhere else sometimes, and they could potentially be leaking out, that's what they're going to protect. That's why they're going to come and punish you so voraciously, is because you're hurting the one thing that they've worked so hard and spent so much money to try to get in the first place. So yeah, they don't like that. They don't like that at all.
But it's a valid, that this whole system of the bidding system versus the fines and the penalties, it's a very delicate balance that they need to find. And the potential danger is that before you get that balance, people might have gotten so many low quality products that they have decided, well, maybe I shouldn't buy on Temu anymore. So it's a very tricky thing that they're a very tricky balance that they're trying to figure out at the moment.
Yeah. And I still do that today, you know, even here in Canada. I will look up stuff on Temu, and I will kind of scroll through Temu. And there are certain product categories where I'll start with Temu, knowing that, well, I'm not in a hurry. That's kind of a key. And then the price savings is worth not needing it right away. Right. And I mean, I think that is the biggest thing, you know, for me. I mean, Amazon Prime, being able to get things within 1 or 2 days that I want right now. Obviously, I can't really go to Temu on that, but that's okay. That's okay. I still value Temu a lot. What do you think some of the misconceptions about Temu are, being that you're kind of in and out of China a lot, and you're able to compare and know and see, you know, what do a lot of people think or believe, or what are some of those misconceptions out there about Temu that people have?
Well, there's a couple. I mean, in the story you just told, in the description you give, you are basically already hooked on Temu. It's just implanted it in your mind. I need to go to Temu to look for low price products. But remember that they started off with giving you a subsidized price. So prices have actually already been rising. They're still cheaper than Amazon. Their target is to be about 75% of the price on Amazon. But they're not as cheap anymore as when you first started buying on them. Also, after a couple of purchases, they will also implement a minimum order value to still get free shipping. So you cannot get that $1-$2 product anymore sent over from Guangdong province. You actually need to buy more. So yes, Temu is cheap, but it's not as cheap anymore as it used to be. Another reason why the prices are rising is because I've described that fully managed model where they ship through little packages in airplanes, but that limits the types of products that you can sell. So, because it needs to be able to fit in a little package in an airplane. So you cannot sell bulky, more high value goods. Also, there's a lot of scrutiny now about the all of those packages coming in that in the US are below the minimus threshold of $800. Here in Europe, it's 150 euro. And all those packages are normally, because the average order of Temu currently is about $40 to $50, they remain far under both the European and the American threshold. But because the volume is so large, you hear more and more calls for a level playing field. So both in the US and in Europe, they are looking into abolishing those thresholds under which they don't have to pay any import taxes. So, and that's what also one of the reasons, in combination with the costs that they have for the logistics when they send everything by airplane and the limitations in the types of products that they can sell, is why they've started a semi-managed model in March. And basically, even the semi-managed model, they don't do the shipping anymore, but they find some merchants that are willing to put the goods already in a warehouse in the country of destination, close to the consumer, and take care of the logistics themselves. Now, Temu will still select the products with them. They will still determine the definite end price, but they don't have the logistics anymore. And that also means that they can now sell very different products than just depending on those airplane packages. So what we've seen recently is they've started selling furniture, they've started selling fat bikes, all kinds of new products with a higher value. So that will also really change the assortment that they have. So those are things as far as assortment and pricing that is already changing and will help them to also get more profitable in the end. Another sort of myth that I hear a lot about Temu here in the Netherlands is that you have a lot of people that say, well, hold on, these prices, that's not possible, right? If the prices are that low, it must be made with child labor or forced labor in China. To which I normally say, well, hold on. I mean, Temu didn't create these factories. They were already there. We were already using them with Western brands to make our products until they became too expensive. And some of those brands moved the manufacturing to Bangladesh because labor was much cheaper then. And what is happening now is that these same factories have overcapacity and they sell those products directly to us through Temu now. So, but Temu didn't change the way these things are manufactured. So that's one of the things that you get. So it's a bit hypocritical from the consumers. Also, another thing is you hear people saying, okay, I know how this company works. They are actually only making 15% of their profit from selling goods, and they make 85% from selling your data. Which, I mean, if you know Pinduoduo, if you know Temu, and if you know that this is a company with the ambition to become number two in America and number one in Europe as an e-commerce platform, what would be the most stupid thing to do is, of course, to sell your customer data to other people. And then if you dive further a bit, then you quite often find out that these are things that have been claimed in reports by short sellers that profit from Pinduoduo's stock going down temporarily. So those are a couple of myths that you see. So it's not always, it doesn't continue to be that cheap. And I don't think that they're selling your data. And Temu didn't change the manufacturing system in China, I think, as far as the way these products are produced.
On one side, I always want to try to encourage people to think a little bit differently about data and privacy and protection. It is always, I would say 95% of the time, it is always in aggregate, and it has always been used in aggregate to measure and decipher the code of what people are up to. However, it's hard to say that when, especially out, and I don't know what it's like for you guys in the Netherlands, but you know, here in Canada, my phone was ringing four or five times a day with just scam calls constantly. It is absolutely something that is completely out of control, especially here in North America. I've had to put call control on my phone where you have to press a number to get through. You can't just have an automated connection happen, which is annoying to have to have done, but it is a nice solution. But this is, again, your data, your emails, the spam emails that you've been getting, or these now phone calls and things when they get their data and then they get leaked on the dark web or what have you. And then we kind of have to deal with that.
It's not as bad as that here in the EU, because that's one of the things that we are good in the EU is make lots of regulation that prevent those things from happening. So but at the same time, we tend to overregulate. But I don't really have that here in the Netherlands, fortunately.
Yeah, sometimes things are overregulated. Sometimes things are underregulated, like food. Mm. now, moving on. Fun fact about what I'm going to ask you about, because I want you to plug your upcoming study trip to China with Kaiser Kuo. Kaiser and I are friendly. I wouldn't say we're friends, but we're more than acquaintances. I used to take, every 6 months, I would take my new batch of startups that we'd invested it in, and we used to take them on, we called it Geeks on a Train. And so we would go from Shanghai, usually we'd go to Hangzhou, and we'd go to Beijing, and we would spend a week to 10 days visiting those top kind of tech companies, and one of them included Baidu. And of course, that was when Kaiser was with Baidu. And so we would go up and he would host us and he would give us a tour. And then the startups would pitch. And then we'd usually go for drinks later in the evening, things like that. And inviting Kaiser would come out. And so I've spent quite a bit of time with Kaiser and followed his podcasts. Incredibly intelligent person. Not only is he a brilliant musician, and don't ever try to talk music with that guy, but
I do.
Oh, well, then maybe you're deep into music as much as he is, but I feel like such a poser anytime I, you know, even think about talking about music or food, frankly, quite the connoisseur of cuisine that guy is, and quite a good cook at it as well. But, he's very, very intelligent. Like, very, you know, his IQ is much higher than mine. He's a great, great guy.
Same here. Yeah.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about your upcoming trip and how you know Kaiser and what you guys are going
to
be doing.
So like you, I've been listening to the Seneca podcast probably since it started in, it must have been 2010, 2011, around that time. Mm-hmm. And I listened to almost all of the podcast. So I think it was either by email or on Twitter, because we, until last month, I actually hadn't met Kaiser in person yet, but we frequently had contact via direct messages on Twitter and email, because we share two passions about tech, China tech, and also about music. And we have a very large overlap in what is called progressive rock. Now, Kaiser tends to go a bit more into the metal side. I go a bit more into the mellower side and into the spacey side. But we have a very large overlap, and we have the same favorite band, Porcupine Tree. So we quite often discuss that and send each other videos. You have to check out this stuff. And so we do have that music connection. And I used to also write for a website, the music reviews about CDs that were coming out for a very long time. So we both are very knowledgeable about music. Now, on the other hand, Kaiser has a very sort of helicopter view of about all kinds of topics in China, where I'm very focused on Chinese internet. So we are two very different China watchers from that perspective. But one thing that we both agreed on is that there's really a lack of knowledge about China. A lack of knowledge of what Kaiser calls cognitive empathy. We don't make the effort to stand in the shoes of China. And it doesn't mean that you have to agree with everything that China does, but you have to understand why they do that. And that's something that is lacking, we think. I have the same thing as far as China tech is concerned. I do a lot of keynotes as well. And what I find is that the knowledge about Chinese tech companies is very limited in Europe, simply because most of the time, yeah, it was something that stayed in China. But now, I mean, yes, we had Shein for a while and we had AliExpress, but now you got TikTok and you got Temu, and there's more companies coming our way. And what I notice is that the knowledge about the companies behind these platforms is so limited that they totally underestimate what is coming their way. So I'm also looking at these things from more like a competitive intelligence point of view. But both of us think that we should learn more about China. We should learn more about the recent history, how China got so big, grew so fast in the past four or five decades, and try to understand what it wants and where it's going. Because we need to be more prepared, because China will only become more important on the world stage. And that's why we said, well, let's team up and do this. So I normally do retail tours, retail innovation tours. And I said, well, let's take part of the tour I have and add more lectures and company visits and turn it into the theme of China's breakneck modernization. And that's basically what we're doing from the 20th of October to the 26th, so 1 week long. We take a group of maximum 18 people on a tour to Beijing, Hangzhou, and Shanghai. And in the morning, we'll give them masterclasses and lectures and explain China to them. And in the afternoon, we have all kinds of cool visits to Baidu, Tencent, one of the biggest live commerce agencies we are visiting in Hangzhou. But we also take people to the countryside in Hangzhou to see rural e-commerce, how a small tea farmer actually does that. And in the evening, we go to different types of cuisine, different styles of restaurants. So we're also going to eat Dongbei Cai, which you must be very familiar with, having lived in Dalian. Of course, Guobao Rou.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, the pork and pineapple.
Yeah.
Big fan. Yeah. Okay. Di San Xian,
Guobao Rou, that kind of stuff. Sichuan Cai, hot pot. So people will get that experience, but we'll also take them to the Forbidden City. We'll take them to a show. We'll take them out to KTV. So you get the knowledge, the experience, and the fun part, and getting to feel the Chinese culture. Because I think that's what we need to do, emerge ourselves for a week.
That's going to be incredible. First of all, I've never heard. I thought I coined Dongbei Cai. Like, I've never heard anybody else say that until you just said that. But I've said that quite a few times, because I found that as I started looking around other places in China for some of these dishes, suddenly they're like, whoa, what are you talking about? So that's amazing. So that's huge. Is there an archetype like these 18 people? And like, this is going to be fascinating if they've never been to China, and especially not only going with yourself, but somebody as connected and knowledgeable as Kaiser, like super uber connected, like you're hard pressed to find somebody who, and it'd probably be great if Kaiser kind of like presents up front, like his own biases around China, because he's been through a lot in his time there. Right. So going straight to the source, what an unbelievable opportunity. And I am saying this so authentically, like, I'm not getting a cut of whatever the 18 people are paying, but oh my gosh, they should pay it, because this is people just don't know what they're in for, right? Yeah. And I hope you guys document or somehow live share something. I would be all over paying attention to that trip and what you guys are doing there. That's going to be incredible. I would go just to be reacquainted in such a short period of time of everything that's happening. I've never been able to go and meet a rural e-commerce, to see how a tea farmer is actually able to leverage technology to do international sales from this little hillside, some area. That is going to be incredible.
Well, we still have seats available, Todd, so don't hold back. I think we've got a great program, so people can find more details on chinatechdrip.com/Seneca. I think we also have a very reasonable price for all of the knowledge and the experiences that we will be sharing.
Where do you have to get into? Where do you go in and out?
Sorry, where are you going on?
Where do you fly into? You got to get yourself to Beijing or what?
Yeah, so people have to arrange their own flights. We're not doing that part. So the actual program starts in Beijing, in the center of Beijing, near Wangfujing. So you have to fly into Beijing and you have to fly out of Shanghai 1 week later.
Yeah.
Continue your travels. That's one of the things that we often say, like, when you're there, why not explore a bit more? And some countries actually at the moment have 15 days visa-free stay in China. So we advise them, maybe come a bit earlier and stay a bit longer.
Yeah. I mean, you guys could even put that together for those of you who are interested to get away from the business and actually do some tourism. here's a contact to somebody we know and trust, and you know, go to Glenn, go to Sonia, you know, whatever you want, right? Could totally do that too. But I don't know, WPIC, if you're listening, maybe this would be good for us to go and cover this.
There must be some budget somewhere.
I'd love, love to go back. Oh my gosh. It's just so many, so many people that I almost considered family that I left behind when I left. It's, I mean, the multinational, multicultural aspect to my circle of friends that became what it is today just by living somewhere else. And you know, being in China, being in Shanghai, one of the most multicultural places on the planet, it seemed, where all my friends were either from South Africa or Germany or the Netherlands. But anyway, I digress. I'm sorry. I had to have a moment of a nostalgia there of, and now I'm excited to go. But okay, we're going to put a pin in episode one and we're going to come back with episode two. So everybody just putting an end on episode one right now. Don't forget to come back next week and get on board with episode two, where we're going to talk about all things like Alibaba and JD and Douyin and things like that. So come back for that one.
Growing a company is hard. Doing it in a foreign market, exponentially so. The best piece of advice I can give you is not to do it alone. When you start looking at the Asia-Pacific region for further expansion possibilities, and I sincerely hope you do, make sure you choose the right partners to do it with. My good friends at WPIC Marketing and Technologies have almost 20 years of experience helping brands, just like yours, enter China, Japan, and Southeast Asia. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Negotiation, and if you're interested in being a guest or want to connect with me or any of our team, please reach out to us at podcast@wpic.co, and be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.